Oh yeah, that's right. So in 10 years, we had really good years. I think the 5 or 8 years before IFQ came in, designated by this council, and you know, they made all the laws for everything in Alaska waters, except for the inside of 12 miles, which was state waters, which went through fishing game. So that was mostly the salmon fishermen, and our fishery was 50 miles offshore all the time on the edge of the whole Japanese current that runs from Fairweather Grounds all the way out to Attu. And I lost touch with everybody. When I'd get home after 40 days, I'd get in the skiff and go right to Chinapoot. That's where I wanted to be. And I didn't get a chance to see very many of my old Saner friends and all my buddies, but those guys stepped up amazing when I got home and injured. They all came to our rescue. Okay. So in 2007, I decided that the regulations, and the council members are here, but anyway, the regulations and the paperwork, I was ready to retire. I just didn't like having to fill out all the logbooks, and I'd get a fine for not signing my name right or whatever, and it was just like, oh my God. But anyway, I didn't want to do that, so I sold the Judy B to the Alaska Leader Group, which was some of the guys are here. I saw them tonight, and they were much bigger, better operation than we were. And the agreement I made with them was, if you take the boat, then you got to take my crew, because I had crew members that were there for 10 years, like brothers to me, all of them. I mean, we were like tight, and they were excellent professional fishermen.
Well, that's your success.
So that was the whole key to my success. These guys, they knew more about the deck than I did. I was just kind of like the greenhorn skipper that didn't know which way he was going. And during those years, we were putting in 800,000. We had 1 year, we had 1 million pounds. But, you know, it was like 300 days of grinding. And it wasn't a lot of good days, and there was a lot of days you had to wait for the weather. So, yeah, so then I decided I wanted to retire. We sold the boat, and Alaska Leader took the boat over. And I bought the Bear, which was a repo sale, and then I spent 6 months refitting it, getting it set up the way I wanted to set it for halibut, and we had some halibut quota left. We sold all the black cod IFQs with the boat. I just didn't quite feel like right about sitting at home and collecting a big check from whoever we sold the boat to for our share of IFQs, so we let them all go with the crew and the boat, and they went on to be successful with it, and they had better markets, and they were more worldly. We were like a little mom and pop organization. And from there, I got that Bear there. And when it came to be about August, I called Barbara up and I said, "Well, what do you think? I got to bring the boat back to Alaska. Why don't you come down and we'll take it up?" And I'm thinking, "Oh my God, you know, is Barbara going to do this with me?" And sure enough, she came down. And I'm thinking, we're going to run a 52 footer all the way to Alaska, just she and I, and we did, and it was like, it was
fun.
45 days of heaven. I mean, all those years that I'd run back and forth to the Seattle shipyard with a boat, we'd never stop, 24/7, we're running. 10 days to get there, 10 days to get back. Well, Barbara and I took 45 days coming out of Seattle, and we had a shrimp pot, and a nice little wine bar, and a crab pot, and we'd stop every night, and I think we hit every hot spring in Southeast that there was. And we'd see a place we'd like for 2 or 3 days, we'd just, oh man, it was great. And when I came around Gore Point, getting ready to come back to Homer, and I told Barbara, I says, "Gee, it's getting to be September, and I gotta go get the halibut yet, you know, because that's the way we're gonna write the boat off." And Barbara says, "Well, don't we wanna go over to Kodiak now?" And she just come across the Gulf, and I'm thinking, holy cow, she's really liking this. So then we thought, well, you know, we're going to go spend our month in the summer catching halibut, and then we're going to go, I'm going to take her out to the Aleutians, and I'm going to take her over into Prince William Sound and show her all these neat spots. And I was thinking, man, here comes the golden years, and wham, bam, one car accident, rolled over, hit my head. Whole life changed, turned upside down. World went backwards, devastated my family. So anyway, I'll take you out in the Aleutians for a little bit and kind of tell you what that's like. I'm probably getting too long-winded here, but There are all kinds of seabirds. I mean, seabirds, unbelievable. And I've always been a birder. Barbara's been a birder. So I always had my Peterson's guide up in the pilot house, and I'm making sure what kind of birds we're seeing and all the things we're looking at. And there's a crested auklet. And those things would, they'd pop up on the deck all the time while you're fishing. And the guys had a little box back in the bait shed, and they had a light bulb in it. And you can see he's kind of looking kind of wet, because when they're in the ocean, they don't get wet like that. But when they start bumping up against material objects like the bulwarks of the deck of the boat, their feathers get kind of ruined, and they can't, and they have a long takeoff range, so they can't get over the bulwarks and get out of the boat. The guys would pick them up and put them in a box for a day, and they had a light bulb in there, and it was all warm, and they'd get toasty, and they'd only let them go at night, because if you let them go in the daytime, the sea pigeons would eat them right up instantly. And the sea pigeons are a fulmer, which I don't know if you have a picture of it. Of course, later on you'll see them, but right there, of course, you can see there's a tufted puffin on deck that we all love. And there's a goonie bird there known as the Lysand's albatross. And there's thousands of them in the Aleutians, and we took some photographers one year from France, wanted to get on the boat and go make a movie about them. So we took them with us and put up with them for 10 days, and they made a goofy movie, and it didn't work out.
Was on the fleet.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they made a movie on the tick and the flea that was on an albatross. I'm going, okay. So, anyway, this bird here is notoriously famous. That's the short-tailed albatross, which they told the fleet that was in the Bering Sea and the Aleutians, there was three left in the world. And if we caught one, the whole North Pacific fleet of longliners was going to be shut down. So we're all going crazy thinking, oh my God, you know, and I could get out to Attu or Kiska and I'd see 20 of them. And they're around my boat. And I'm going, oh my God, how am I going to set my hooks over the stern without one of them getting caught? So we worked with Ed Melvin from the University of Washington, and he was the bird guy that was going to figure out the solution to stop the birds from picking your bait off the hooks when it went into the water. So we'd take some of their bird people with us, and we hooked and crooked. And after 10 boats involved in a year, we figured out that we had these rubber, surgical cords hanging off the boat with a bunch of streamers on it where the birds couldn't fly in and get the hooks. And it kind of eliminated the big problem. So then they backed off, and now there's lots of short-tailed albatross, but they're only on one volcano in Japan where they nest. And that's like a primo picture one.
Streamers.
What?
They're still using the streamers.
Yeah, everybody's mandatory has to use the streamers now when you set gear. And the streamers hang out over the gear and make kind of a corridor that the boat can't, I mean the birds can't get through. I had a guy on the boat that was a really good photographer and a really good friend, so I take him around Dutch Harbor and let him photograph birds, and I've got all kinds of great bird pictures, but these are just surf birds around Dutch Harbor. And the next picture, Barb.
I'm sorry.
The next picture is storm petrels. And we had lots of storm petrels out there, and we all loved them, because they're real delicate, like a baby pigeon. And the guys would always have one of them in the box, trying to get them warmed up. And then, like I said, you had to let them go at nighttime because the fulmers were like by the thousands, and they were so aggressive that they'd eat them up if they saw even just the slightest bit of a flinch and not being right. And the fulmers were so thick out there. That's a fulmer right there in one of John's best photographs. He's been notarized all over different magazines for his photography. But they were so thick when you would be when in calm water like that at nighttime, and you'd be hauling black cod gear up at the roller, and the roller man had to see clearly in the water to be able to gaff the fish, because they're coming one every 4 seconds if there's a fish on every hook. So he's got to be able to gaff the fish, put it in checker, and get the next one. So you want to see down in the water to know what's coming. And there'd be so many fulmers around the gear thinking they were going to pick that little piece of herring off the hook as it's coming by, that it'd be like as big as this center of this counter here, just like thousands of them, and they're all clucking like chickens. And we hated them. And they made so much noise in the night, and you could tap your gaff against the steel boat, and one little clink of the steel, bam, they'd fly right away. But then they'd turn around and come right back. So they were a bit of a problem, but I better keep on moving here, or I won't tell too many stories. Oh yeah, so the other interesting story, we were on the Pacific side of the Aleutians out by M. Chitka, and I was hauling at night, which we tried not to do, but a lot of times you had to because the current was so strong that a guy couldn't be on the roller and driving into the current in the dark and figure out where he was going. So that takes me off the deck, puts me in the pilot house, I'm steering, I'm looking in the radar and I'm seeing these fuzzy things coming in radar almost like it's weather. Well, next thing I know, I look, and it's shearwaters by the thousands. And next thing I know, they're hitting the rigging and hitting the lights, and I'm hearing them on the deck, and their little claws are scrambling all over the top of my pilot house on the aluminum. And I look out back, the back window, and the guy that's at the roller, he stopped the roller, which, like, when you're a longliner, you never stop the Gertie. Never stop the Gertie. I mean, it's like, if you stop the Gertie, you're not making money. So you keep the Gertie hauling. He stopped the Gertie and squatted down and held his hands over his head because birds were just flying into him and hitting him left and right. And the other guys that were on deck were all getting hit, and they all went back in a bait shed. And this big, huge flock of birds just hit everything, everybody. They also dive under the water and swim. So you'd be looking down in the water, and they'd be coming out of the water and up at you. I mean, it was like the birds. The guys were just going nuts, and they were going, we're not hauling, we're going back in the bait shed, and they all went back in the bait shed, and these birds kept coming, and I think, I wrote it down in my logbook, but there was like over 1,000 birds on the deck when they all came out and they were gone by. So the guys got the shovels out there, and they're shoveling them overboard, because you go to grab a seabird, man, and he's going to bite you bad. I mean, he doesn't know anything about being touched. So I go up on the bow, and here's a goonie bird up there. And I tell one of I say goonie bird, which is a albatross. And there's an albatross up there. And I tell one of my crew members, I go, well, I don't know. And he comes back and he says, I'm not touching that damn bird. And I'm going, come on, man. I said, I'll go get him. So I go up there to get him, and he starts clacking his beak at me. And I mean, this guy, I mean, he's big as a goose. And he's going to bite you hard if you don't watch out. So when he wasn't looking, I grabbed him right by the neck and whang, threw him right over the side, and he does about 15 steps across the water and takes off, and he was no worse for the wear. But anyway, but they will scare you. Okay, I don't know which way we're going. We're going to Dutch Harbor now.
Yeah, we just did this. Just a Glaucus.
Show them that next one.
This is the Glaucus.
Oh, yeah, that's the Glaucus skull there. That's one of John's photos.
Which is unusual.
Yeah. And then there's the eagle in a crane in Dutch Harbor. That I bet you that nest has been there for 25 years. And that crane has not been able to move because, you know, you can't mess with an eagle's nest, right? You can't, and there's a guy got $200,000 crane sitting there, and I bet you to this day that eagle's nest is still there. So it's kind of amazing to me. Now, the next picture is of Priest Rock, which is the entrance to Dutch Harbor. It's like the iconic rock of the Bering Sea. When you come into Dutch Harbor, you're going to come by Priest Rock. And it's not a very good picture, as you can see, because it was in the fog. Priest Rock is always in the fog. And it's always blowing there. So it's like everybody knows, and it's supposed to be a picture of a bishop with his arms out, with his cape, and, you know, the Russian Orthodox Church is right there in Dutch Harbor. So, and this Russian Orthodox Church, my relief skipper and I, we were... unusually, we were in Dutch Harbor on Easter Sunday, and he was religious, and I was religious, and he says, well, let's go to church. And I went, yeah, let's go to church. So we get up the next morning, and we go to the Russian Orthodox Church, and we think, well, is it even open? Can we get in? Or, you know, it's so iconic, you know. And we go in there, we're the only two white boys in the whole place, and there was a whole mass was sung by the Aleuts in Russian. And the pictures and the gold and the stuff that was original from the day that was built there was just incredible. So it was a pretty unusual experience. I felt really honored to be able to do that. What are you going to next, Barb? Oh, so there's the Judy B coming into Dutch Harbor to unload in the wintertime. And I just offloaded 140,000 pounds of black cod to the Japanese ship. So then we come into town, we change crews, we reprovision, get groceries, and, you know, for we had 8 to 10 guys on the boat, so, and a great cook. It was a lot of you guys know Jack Hughes, Jack and Eileen Hughes. It was Jack's brother, Joe. And these are just good shots of John. We ought to roll on through those, huh?
What's that big wave?
Big following sea. And you can't see it in the picture, but there's our Tory line that usually hangs up in the air and flags out. But the sea was so big behind us when the boat went down in the swell, then the Tory line would drag in the water. And as soon as the swell go by, it would pop up. Yeah, it's in the bottom corner there.
Right in.
Just some nice pictures of the Aleutians, and that's the way that Bering Sea looks all the time right there. These clouds, I love their lenticular clouds, and I noticed when we came in tonight, there was a bunch of lenticular clouds out at Augustine, and I always find them for fair weather for a couple, 3 or 4 days right behind it. So we were always happy to see those, but it scared us when the lenticular clouds got on top of the volcanoes. And you'd say the volcano was capping up, and everybody'd say, "You're going to blow." So we'd always be real careful when they were doing that. And that's actually a picture that Barbara took out of my bedroom window of Homer and the spit in the back in the downground. You can't see it, but pretty phenomenal sunrise. These are the fog. You'd often see it in the Aleutians. That's a real common sight to see. The fog would be on the Pacific side or the Bering Sea side, and it'd be crawling over the mountains. And they say the Bering Sea in the summertime is 80% fog. So a lot of times you could see your masthead. If you crawl up there, you'd be in the sunshine. And it was just hundreds of miles of solid fog. And that's more Aleutian pictures, that you look at those mountains and you think, man, I just want to run up those barefooted. And it was all just low grass, no trees, never saw a tree. You know, the wind was so phenomenal there that it was amazing. That's Semisopochnoi volcano in Amchitka Pass there. And more pictures of the, that's right by Adak, that's Great Sitkin Volcano. And that's Vezvedov Volcano right by Chernovsky. And next one's, those pinnacles are kind of common to see all around the Aleutians like that. But the rock formation's just, you know, beaten by the coast and the waves, just like incredible. And this is where I thought I was invincible. That's me standing under that rock. Before I was injured, of course, I thought nothing could stop me. So we took that picture of me holding it up. And the next picture, if you see that rock in the bottom there, there's the Judy B in the background. Look at the size of the thing. So I'm hoppy. I'm all the time asking him when he's out there, because he's often time in some of those same areas. And I go, is Christmas Tree Rock still standing? I mean, you look at the thing, and it's conglomerate rock. And it's stones falling out of it all the time, and the waves are beating away at it. And that picture was taken, from photograph, because we didn't have cell phones in those days, and I took a picture of the photograph to keep it. But I mean, it's like I can't imagine the thing. I thought it was going to tip over when I was under it. And that's a picture of one of the crew members hauling on the Judy B when the Alaska Leader owned it. And you just see the guy standing at the roller with a big wave coming right on him, so it wasn't always pleasant there. This picture I really love because it's showing the true color of a black cod. And if you can see it, yeah, you can see that picture. It's kind of a dark green. And as soon as you cut the head off and throw them on in the checker, they turn black. And all the crew members would always say, one of these days I'm going to have a Ferrari and I'm going to paint it black cod green. And there's our buddy the whales, always at our side, always chasing us around. A huge menace. When Kelly and I started with the Judy B the first year, we bought black cod pots. Thinking we were, because the whales were just such a menace, and he'd already experienced it. And to throw those pots down in the Aleutian with the Japanese current and the coral that was on the bottom, we lost almost all of it in a matter of about 3 months. And the current would take the buoys down to the bottom, and you'd have a 60-inch buoy. I can't hold my arms because I don't have any control over them, but as big around as I could reach, a 60-inch buoy, and we would web it. I taught my crew how to web it like the Japanese do, or I should say my Japanese technician that was on the boat taught us all how to web the buoy. And then you could throw the buoy over the stern, and you could hold it in 2 fingers. with the boat running 9 knots in the, and it would break the surface tension and the buoy would just float like nothing. You throw a regular buoy over that had no web on it and it was smooth, it would suck it so hard it'd pull it right out of your hand or pull you overboard. So we put it in the current so the buoys wouldn't go down. Well, then when the current would get so bad, we'd have a hard ball, which is what draggers use, that the plastic material is about an inch thick. So it can go to the bottom on a trawl and come back up and not be damaged. So we'd put one of those on our buoy setup, and then we'd have two flags, and I mean have a flag and two buoys that were 60-inch buoys with web on them. Well, the buoys would go down, and we'd come looking for them, and it was like, it's gone. Where is it? We'd wait for 12 hours sometimes till the tide was slack, and boom, up pops the buoys because we had the hard float on there. So everybody's happy. Oh, man, we don't have to stick gear. We're ready to roll. And we'd go get the buoy, and I pull up next to the buoy, and there's the buoy with no web on it. And I'm looking at it, I'm going, what the hell? And all the web was laying right beside of it, still in its diamonds that were about 3-inch diamonds, like you'd see on a glass ball that the Japanese do. And the buoy had gone so far down that it compressed to nothing, and it had squirted out through one of those little 6-inch holes. And the flagpole would actually have coral stuck in the flag, where it went down to 300 fathoms, laid straight out down at 300 fathoms. 300, our other end was at 600. And we'd see them like that all the time. So that's kind of what we were dealing with. And then you start hauling it up, and you'd be getting fish like crazy, and you think, oh, baby, we're in them. And next thing you know, here come a killer whale right beside you. And like all the fish go away, no more. Okay, we've got to keep moving. Oh, yeah, so there's krill on the beach, which is actually over in Chinapoot. And it happens over there this time of year. Every year, Barbara and I would see it. And we wake up in the morning, and you hear the gulls just going crazy at a low tide in the morning. And you walk out there, and there'd be a line of it, like a tide line, like the kelp does. And it'd be a whole tide line of krill. And the whales are here right now, and probably that's where there's krill around. I haven't been in Chinapoot to see if it's on the beach, but that's what the krill look like that the whales are after. This picture is one of my favorites, of course, because I'm standing butt deep in black cod. And the way a conventional longliner works, we tried to duplicate the halibut schooners because, as far as I was concerned, they were the best of the best because they've been doing it for 100 years already before us. Why change it? So we did everything the same way, rotation. Every guy had to be able to make his rotation. If you didn't make your rotation, you weren't a full chairman. So if you got on board and said, oh, yeah, I can do this, well, we'd know in about a week whether you could do it or not. And, you know, you couldn't keep up. And so a guy that's standing in the checker, like I am there with a green jacket on, you were expected to be able to do about 600 to 800 fish in a rotation. So if we caught 600 or 800 fish, when the last end came aboard, you were supposed to have your fish done and pick up and go bait your next gate, and everybody came out and scraped. Well, this was about 2,000 fish off of Cape Fairweather there, and I wasn't keeping up too good. So there's my nephew there and some black cod. See them? They're all headed there and ready to be scraped and gutted, and we caught a couple of brown crab, and everybody was happy then because that slipped into the pot, and I don't think we ever told nymphs about it. And there's another good day. I think Kelly was running the boat for that one. And that would be a typical haul with black cod, halibut, redfish. And everybody was happy when that was happening. And there's my son Pat sitting up front here when he was 11. Can you read that, what it says on there? And that was at Attu. And we caught, I mean, that
20 plus.
Yeah, that. We took the ear bones out. We sent them in to Nymphs or Aug Bay, and they told us that fish was over 120 years old. And so we took Pat when he was 11. That wasn't the smartest thing to do, to take a kid from Dutch Harbor to Attu, which is 800-mile run. We were bucking into 45 knots. Everybody was seasick. And if you want to break a kid of fishing, go do that. So anyway, poor guy. And there he is out there with 8 professional fishermen that, and he's the little guy, and I remember he'd wake up in the morning and he'd be putting his gloves on, his white gloves on, and he would be, he'd be coating his whole hands with that atomic bomb liniment, heating, you know what I mean, for your sore muscles. He'd have both hands all coated with that, and then he's putting his gloves on, and I'm going, why aren't you out there on deck? And he's going, Dad, I got to get my hand in. You know, so anyway, he'd be out there doing it, but he decided after looking at what we were doing when he was 18, it was like, I don't think I want to keep doing this business. But anyway, there's another, you can see John's name on that picture. I think he squirted it a little bit one way or the other, but to change the colors, but there's a bunch of rough hooligans with a bunch of giant black cod. That's about as big as they get. So they were all hooping and hollering, raving over the big black cod. I wasn't running that trip. There's my son, Pat, with a big halibut that they caught on the Bear, and I think he was running it for that trip. So those are his fish, not mine. And there's one of our crew members. I love that photograph right there. But he's hauling buoy line. You see there's no hooks. So you got to haul 500 fathoms of buoy line before you even get to the anchor. And then you get to the anchor, and then you start hauling hooks for about 2 hours, and then you get to the other end, and it's 600 fathoms of buoy line. And so, you know, he's kind of smoking his cigarette and getting ready to have to start hauling hooks. Okay, babe. And that's Pat with some more nice halibut on the Bear. That's when we were kind of thinking we were retired until I had a little car accident and screwed everything up. And there's a leased auklet on one of the crew member's shoulders. And they put those in a box, too, to warm them up. But you'd find the leased auklet in the big halibut. And those little auklets were flying down to 30 fathoms. You know, they fly on the water. You know, all of those birds do. And they go down there chasing minnows, and all of a sudden, boom, a big halibut just jumped right off the bottom and grab him right up. And we'd cut the belly open and find a couple rocks and a couple birds in his stomach. And that was life in the Aleutians, the way they did it. And there's another good halibut set there. And Pat with a great big monster there. And we'll go back to that one. Oh, you can't see the look on his face, but I don't think he was real happy that day. Yeah, how come I always get the big halibut? I got to get down there. No. And this is a happy camper there. That's Pat and the fish on the Bear. And when the checker floods over and you start pulling fish back, because the checker can only hold so many fish, and then you pull the fish back down the sides, and those are all 40, 60 pounders going back there, and everybody's happy when they're seeing those. This is my favorite picture because I like to see photographs of me standing. And that was the last halibut I ever gaffed. And I almost missed him. Look, I got a bad gaff on him anyway. And this is a picture from the house. Back in the early days, there was the whole Aleutians covered in coral at 300 to 500 fathoms. And, you know, you watch all of movies and shows you see on TV, and they're talking about the coral reefs, and, you know, they're all 20, 30 fathoms, 60 fathoms deep. I mean, this stuff is so deep, I don't think very many people even knew it was there, nor did we. And we'd catch it on a hook once in a while and bring it to the surface. And if it was a rough day, you'd see this beautiful piece of coral hanging on the hook, and bang, it would hit the side of the boat and just shatter into 1,000 pieces and go to the bottom. So I had a tote up on the bow next to the anchor winch, and I filled it full of angel farts, which are those little white puffy styrofoam things that you use in packing. And I had that box full of them, and every time I'd get a real nice piece like that, I'd take it straight away and put it up there in that tote. And after a year, I had some really nice pieces. And then I came home, and Pat and I, the house had a design for a china cabinet. Well, we didn't have any china. He's like, what are we going to do with that space? So it was like 3 foot wide, and I said, well, we're going to build a dry aquarium and put glass over it and make this coral display. And we sent Barbara out of the house that day. It was just getting built, and there was new floors. And Pat and I brought buckets of cement and chicken wire, and I made a scene that I thought the bottom of the ocean looked like. And then I had those mounted fish and the coral and made an underwater scene. And those are some of the most extravagant pieces of coral that you'll ever find. And that picture, it you can see, is out the window through the house. And the black cod there in the front is got a tag on it, and we had names for all those corals. Now you see right above the black cod is a piece that kind of looks like a brain that we call brain coral, and on top of it is a little bitty crab that comes out of 500 fathoms, and it's called a spider crab. Now, I think we'll see more pictures of that. Now that is a golden turbot, and you might catch, oh no, it's a black cod, I'm sorry, that's what's known as skillfish. And I would say 1 in 700,000 pounds of fish, you'd see one of those. I mean, it was just real rare to see them. We'd always eat them because we couldn't sell them. And they were a little bit like a mix between a black cod and a snapper, but they were really good. And this turbot, a golden turbot, I mean, that's probably 1 in a million. And we fished turbot for a number of years as well. And he normally looks just like the color of a halibut. The same color as a halibut, except darker. And there's the spider crab that I was telling you was on top of the brain coral. And that guy right there would fit in a Folger's coffee can, a big coffee can. And there he is. Maybe you can see him right on the black cod's, right over the black cod's back of that little, I had one, you know, that came up and he was on a piece of coral and I put him in a coffee can and protected him for a couple of years till I got all this stuff together and then we made that dry aquarium in the house. And this was one that I almost took out of my case and brought to the North Pacific Council and said, BS. Because that black cod right there has been gaffed in the side of the face, ripped his whole cheek off. And he had a tag on him, and he'd been living for 3 years. And you can see how rude his mouth looks in that picture. That looks like it's like a fake. But I had a guy make a mold of it out of fiberglass. You know, those fish you see in those pictures are made out of fiberglass. And pretty amazing how hardy. I mean, you catch halibut all the time, you'll see. The Halibut Commission calls them priors because they've been caught before and their lip might be messed up or they might have a gaff hole in them. But they're so prolific on the bottom. They're amazing how strong they are. But, I mean, that guy had his whole face ripped off and he lived through it enough to eat more bait for another 3 years. Where are you, Bob?
Just in the aquarium.
Oh, yeah, so that's the inside of the aquarium kind of showing you the design of the bottom that I was trying to duplicate. And we never done any of that before. We just took chicken wire and some cement and made a hell of a big mess in the living room. Barbara wasn't real happy with us when she came back home. But anyway, it's a dry aquarium and you don't have to ever clean it, wash it, nothing. You can just look at it. And I can't turn my head that far. Barbara, you can read that for me, will you?
Well, I don't have the microphone. They can probably, but can you read it? Can you see it?
No. Can everybody read that? Can you see that?
Yeah.
But when I saw that thing, I went, holy cow, how profound is that? And I don't even know who said it or who wrote it. And I never found out anything about it. So it's cast in bronze. And it's really true. I mean, I think the great thing about the North Pacific Council is they come here. They go to Sitka. They go to Kodiak. They try to make their meetings even in some of the villages, even in Nome. So the local fishermen can testify of what they know and what they see. And I think that's really, really important. I mean, scientific technology is one thing, but guys who live out there like we lived out there, you know it in a whole different perspective. So, and the council is really, really great about that, and I think that's why they've been so successful.
Okay, that's the end.
And that's the end. My cocktail is almost empty. Well, all I can say is thanks to all of you that have helped Barbara and I in this community, and my God, Dr. Bell, all the doctors, Renee Alvarez, Dr. Polis, everybody's been to our house, no charge, come in, help out. Dr. Heston, Jim, he was at my house yesterday fixing my shoulder. You know, it's just like, oh yeah, man, we'll come right over there and get you fixed up. And just and family, all the people that have helped me is like over the top. I mean, it's just really, really unbelievable. Even people I grew up with in high school, they still they reach out to us and have helped me. And of course, if I'd never made it without my wife, I mean, it's
he's
like
he's a good guy.
Good bullshitter.